This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, every hero needs a Sam, the unlikely best friend in speculative fiction.
Now, Jules, this is another episode suggestion by you. God, I keep saying that now. Like, have I had any episode suggestions recently?
Yeah, I'm sure you have.
I'm really dropping the ball. What prompted it?
Honestly, I'm not really sure. I think it just... I have had a few nights where it's been quite difficult to sleep. Just because sleep and I don't tend to get on very well, and the war was redeclared recently for some reason.
Right.
So what I do instead is I lie there and I think about plots, or I think about books I've read, or I think about what to talk about on a podcast.
Of course
you
do.
I'm just like, oh, look at all these unprepossessing best friends in speculative fiction. We haven't done one on that.
And we haven't, you're right. And actually, because we haven't talked about it. I mean, we've mentioned the Sarky sidekick.
Yep.
And we've looked at kind of friendship within fiction. But we haven't actually narrowed in on this particular kind of friend who features a lot in especially the kind of the epic stories. And I guess we should just call him, the Samwise Ganji.
Yeah.
Of the stories.
And it is basically, have you ever read that young adult book? It's a contemporary fiction one called The Duff. Duff is an unappealing and unflattering sort of acronym for designated ugly fat friend.
Oh, which, wow.
I mean, that book actually unpacks that whole sort of preconception. So, yeah, it sounds bad from the title, but actually when you read it, that's not what it's pushing. But that's kind of what this is. And I didn't realise how many of them that had been shoved, as you say, especially into epic fantasy.
Yeah.
Literally to be kind of appendages to the hero. But what's really interesting, and we can go into this a bit more later, is the fact that yes, you have your hero who is a bit more traditional in terms of, you know, appearance and what he does and how he acts, etc. Mm. As in, you can pretty much tick off point for point what he's going to be like.
Mm.
And this, if you want to say, you know, inverted commas, this Duff friend character, actually, tends to be quite unprepossessing, looks unlikely, isn't particularly courageous to start with, probably doesn't really want to go on an adventure. And sometimes sort of literally attaches himself like a limpet to the hero at the start, and it's kind of like the hero feels a bit sorry for him, so allows it but doesn't really like him that much.
Yeah.
And as it goes along, it completely changes, and quite often these characters are the ones who save the entire story and get no credit for it.
Yeah. I think it comes from a really... To be honest, I think that the trope might have been used by some people as a very lazy way of creating contrast.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was for originally.
Yeah, and it literally was that make someone look hotter by having someone ugly next to them, by having someone who's a bit cowardly, by having somebody who's a bit nerdy, and it makes the other character look more roguish and charming without you having to resort to them being ridiculous.
Yeah.
And actually, that frustrates me, because I think that kind of trope does come from Samwise Ganji, except people who fall back on that really fail to understand what the character of Samwise Ganji actually was, who he was, and the premise of the entire story. And they did it. I quite like that line in the Lord of the Rings film trilogy, where Frodo literally says, "And Sam, Frodo wouldn't have gotten anywhere without his Sam."
Yeah.
Because it genuinely highlights the fact that Sam, who starts out as this character who'd never left the Shire, didn't really want to leave the Shire, and was kind of pushed into it, and all he really wanted to do was go home. And then the next thing you know, he's literally carrying Frodo
Yeah.
through Mordor. And he's also the character who is then able to recover and go home. And I'm not, you know, trying to say, oh, but I'm not trying to boo-boo what Frodo went through. He was deeply traumatized and changed. But there is a real strength to Sam in that Sam just wanted, he wanted to go home, but he was also kind and he didn't want to just leave. His bravery was next level.
Yeah, it was. He went out of loyalty. He stayed out of loyalty. Even when Frodo tries to drive him away, he stays. He goes after him. He thinks this isn't right. He's not acting like himself.
Yeah.
And he's always unassuming. And there's a simplicity and a sort of resiliency to his character. And I suppose the thing worth bearing in mind is obviously Tolkien was working out a lot of his issues from World War One, having gone off to war with three friends and only come home with one of them. Which is what the four hobbits literally stand for him and these three other young men. And obviously there were slight differences in ages as well. And it's worth thinking in hobbit terms in the sense of, you know, Frodo's like in his early 50s, which means he's just about hit adulthood as a hobbit.
Yeah.
Whereas Samwise is kind of in his 30s, his early 30s, which means he's sort of mid to late teens. And there is a world of difference between 15, 16 and someone who's 21.
And then you have Merry and Pippin is a literal child.
Yeah. So, I mean, the whole sort of going off on this impossible quest to destroy something that ultimately Frodo fails to do because he falls at the absolute last hurdle, just like everyone else has before him.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't have got that far without Sam. Literally, as you say, carrying him up Mount Doom.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, there's always this comment on weight.
Yes, it's a really... I mean, I think certainly with Lord of the Rings, when Tolkien wrote it, it wasn't a big issue. That was kind of like, this is obviously a comfortable creature who enjoys home life and food and stuff, and there's nothing wrong with it. And literally, that is kind of what hobbits are supposed to be like.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what Bilbo was like, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. And then everyone's been sort of influenced when they write epic fantasy by Lord of the Rings, which is understandable, but they've completely misunderstood Sam's character and his character journey and what the point of him was. And it's like, let's have a slightly laughable fat friend for the hero.
Yeah. And some authors actually really do turn that trope on its head, and I really, really like that. And some don't quite manage it. I think there's always meant to be this kind of this undercurrent that part of the fat friend's journey is to prove that despite their appearance, they're not useless.
Yeah.
And that actually, despite their appearance, they have a good heart. And it's also usually linked to stupidity as well, which really frustrates me, in that these characters are usually quite seen as quite talentless or fumbling or ignorant.
Yeah, they're the ordinary friends, aren't they?
Exactly. which really, really frustrates me. And it makes me think of a series that I read as a child called the Windsinger Trilogy.
Yeah.
And it was The Windsinger, Slaves of the Mastery, and I can't remember what the third book was called.
It wasn't The Wind on Fire, was it? Because
The Wind on Fire, yeah. And you had the main characters, and it followed a set of twins, and the girl was called Kestrel, I remember, and I can't remember, Bowman, I think, was the boy. And they had a boy in their class called Mumpo.
Yeah.
And Mumpo was dumb and big and fat and ugly, basically. And he was part of, because the Windsinger story, it's a society that which has been split into different classes, and it's all run with examinations. And depending what level you are, you get to be in different societies. So you had grey, maroon, orange, scarlet, and white. And if you were white, you had all the riches, all the comforts, everything like that. If you were grey, you were the lowest of the low.
Yeah.
So yeah, they have Mumpo, who has this absolute crush on Kestrel for the entire story, and ends up kind of following along with them onto in this adventure as they escape the city. Just because he's very, he's fond of her, and they don't really want him there, and he kind of gets in the way. And then as kind of time goes on, he becomes a much more durable character, to the point that in future books, he's strong, he's smart, and it's this nice way that they basically said he was stuck where he was. Very much because of the style of education that he was being given and the
Yeah.
care that was being given to him as well. He was basically abandoned. And I quite liked that because, I mean, the whole story on one level addresses how we perceive intelligence. And actually, I think it was a not particularly, covered up discussion about our current education system, to be honest.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you put a monkey, a fish, and an elephant in front of a tree and say the one who can climb the tree is the intelligent one, then you're going to get one result every time, aren't you?
It says Einstein. Yeah, exactly. The Einstein saying, if you judge a fish by his ability to climb a tree, he will forever think that he's stupid. Ignoring the fact that fish can oddly enough swim very well. So Mumpo really sort of comes into himself as the books go on, to the point that he becomes quite a leader and a warrior. And Kestrel's little sister falls head over heel in love with him. Her name is Pinpin, Pinto, I think. And it's a really interesting kind of look. But there is this kind of there's this level of we're not really talking about this too much, but I just do feel like it's worth mentioning the fact that in order to gain intelligence and in order to be seen as a worthy character, an element of weight loss needs to have happened.
That does seem to happen. I mean, really, it depends a little bit on the setting. I mean, I do sort of see exactly what you mean there, and it's a case of equating the fat friend with being of lesser value unless they sort of lose weight, and then they magically their mental faculties sharpen up at the same time because clearly it was the fat doing it, you know?
Clearly, yeah.
But there are.
Or that they couldn't be a hero while still, being of a larger weight.
Yeah, I do think it kind of works in Game of Thrones with Samwell Tarly because he doesn't really change that much.
He doesn't know.
He is what he looks like, and I suppose all his changes are internal, and he benefits a lot from his friendship with Jon Snow. Jon Snow benefits a lot from his friendship from with him as well. Because it starts off that he kind of resents him but feels sorry for him and just can't stand seeing him bullied and steps in. And obviously, Sam's so grateful he just sort of limpets onto him. And we've probably all experienced that with someone at some point in our lives, not based on what they look like, but just in a case of you've stepped in but you're not necessarily wanting to be besties kind of thing. And it turns out you're wrong. And actually, they have a lot of value, and it's a case of you're not seeing it because they don't perceive it themselves. And as it goes on, he obviously Samwell sort of he I mean he's kind of brilliant really, isn't he?
He is, and this is the other thing is that Samwell is intelligent. They didn't do, because it's one or two things, okay? If they're large, they're either stupid or they're a nerd. And I'm like, oh. But as in, like, yeah, they're either very, very bookish, and Samwell is, he's incredibly bookish. He wants to be a Meister. He has a good memory, and he's got a good analytical mind. He's also loyal, and that's one of the key traits that we see in this character, is this sense of loyalty. But also usually this sense of loyalty and hero worship as well.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that usually. What I suppose I like about Samwise Gamgees and obviously Samwell Tarly is that when Frodo and when Jon Snow are being dicks, they will actually just tell them that that's what's happening.
Yeah, they will turn around and say, actually, you
You're
know
wrong.
what? And I do like that. I really appreciate seeing that character dynamic explored. And as we say, it did start, well, I say not necessarily, but the biggest sort of trendsetter was definitely Samwise. And then we've kind of had a few sort of different in what's the word? Incarnations
Yep, that's the one you
since,
want.
yeah, dotting about. And we see it a lot in TV as well. We see it a lot, and I think probably another relatively good example is probably Hunk from Voltron. Have you watched Voltron? I showed you the first episode.
I've only ever seen that first episode.
I'm ashamed. In which it's you start out, you meet Lance. And Lance is definitely not the typical hero. In fact, the typical hero is probably Keith. But Lance is annoying and adorable. And Hunk is kind of someone who sort of they hang around, that they're friends with each other. And you really do start out with Hunk just being the fat one who's obsessed with food, if that makes sense. And I thought, oh, great, so here we go again. And they did play into that trope a little bit. But they also did some actually really cool things with Hunk, especially in the latest season. And it's the level of loyalty, but also the level his ability to call out bullshit. And in the latest season, they did have a really nice bit where he says, look, I get it, you're all brave. And heroes, and you don't know how to talk about the fact that you're afraid. Well, take it from someone who's a coward. I can help you talk through what you're going through right now, because he openly admits that he's the one who's most afraid most of the time. And later on, it's addressed that says, yeah, he is the one who is most afraid most of the time, and is the one who's going, come on, guys, this plan is crazy. But he does it, and actually, that takes even more courage. And analytically, he's has his professional area. He's an engineer, and he's good at what he does, and he's good at figuring things out. And I like that they spread out sort of some of those tropes among different characters, and it wasn't just a very, very simple one level. So that even though he fit within that best friend archetype, he was so much more than that. He wasn't just the best friend. He was a pillar within this structure of the story.
I mean, I haven't seen it, so I can't comment, but I totally take your word for it. Yeah, a couple of other examples. I want to talk about Butters from the Dresden Files, who is probably my favourite character.
Yes. I got angry messages from you.
Yeah, she did. On several occasions from se I'm on book 13 now, so hopefully it won't be for too much longer. But and ultimately my favourite book so far has been Deadbeat, and a large part of that was actually Butters. I mean, the whole riding into battle on a dead T-Rex was kind of like a big deal as well. I was totally there for that. But Butters is just brilliant. And every time Harry says something, even in his head, like, oh yeah, there was the little guy, I'm like, shut up, Harry.
To be fair, Harry is like 6 foot whatever, so Butters is the little guy.
I know, and Butters is like my height, but I'm still going, shut up. No, he's great. He's really not the ride into battle type of character, generally speaking, and yet he always comes good when he has to, when the situation calls for it, and the number of times he's patched Harry up.
Yeah. And my God, he loves Polka. Polka will never die.
That was like the best bit of the entire series. It peaked. It can't get any better. I'm waiting for it to. It's just not happening.
For those who haven't read the Dresden Files, there is a rather famous scene where monsters are basically trying to break through into the apartment door, and Harry's there, and Butters is freaking out, and Harry's, well, spoiler, Harry's brother is there as well. And Butters is freaking out, and Harry's trying to calm down. He says, listen, we're not going to die. You know why we're not going to die? Because I'm too stubborn to die. Thomas is too pretty to die. And you're not going to die because Polka will never die. Say it with me. Polka will never die. And it becomes their battle cry. And it's just
it just comes up again
shouting
in the books.
I've got a T-shirt that says Polka will never die on it now.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. Butters is a forensic scientist. That's what he's got his doctorate in. He prefers working with corpses because they don't do too much talking, usually. Although, mm-hmm. you know, with Harry around, who knows? But he is actually a medical doctor because you need to be in order to qualify to do autopsies, which is what he spends a lot of his time doing. And so Harry takes advantage of this and is very reasonably priced, as in free services, every time he can't afford to go to a hospital. And, you know, Butters patches him up a lot. And then there's various other things where Butters gets into all sorts of scrapes with him. And he is just not designed for battle, is he? He's not a race car. He's a comfortable family sedan.
Yeah, he is.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There is a place for both of those vehicles. And one is definitely more useful than the other. And he's just great. And he just sort of, what I love about him is he just accepts who he is. Mm. He's kind of fine with it. He hasn't got a massive chip on his shoulder. He hasn't got short man syndrome.
No, and he's not constantly trying to be something he isn't and therefore getting in the way. He's always like, nope, I'm noping out of this. This is not what I came here to do.
Yeah.
So he will throw authority over Harry when he needs to.
Yeah.
Because he will turn around and be like, nah, your insides are coming out, so you're just going to lie here for a bit now.
Yeah, your body has revoked its permission for you to abuse it anymore this week. Anyway, he's a great character. Another one that probably more people will be familiar with, is Neville Longbottom.
Yes.
Who was clearly set up so that we would think he would be kind of a patsy initially, and turned out to very narrowly missed out on being the chosen one.
Yeah.
And again, would not have been able to close out that entire arc without Neville's actions, without the fact that Neville did find his courage in the end.
He did. And it is actually quite interesting that it's pointed out that in the first book, Neville gets points for displaying courage.
Yeah.
Because he does actually stand up to the others. He stands up to Harry. And this is interesting because we mentioned the hero worship before. And there's definitely an element of hero worship with Neville, with Harry.
Yeah.
You know, he looks up to him. He thinks he's amazing. But he is also willing to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to let you jeopardize the house, basically. He's defending Gryffindor. And I really liked that about Neville. He was, to begin with, I found him to be an irritating but very believable character.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's 12 years old. He's come from a background where he's been bullied. His parents were tortured into insanity. And he's basically kind of, I mean, I'd say he's dyslexic. As far as whenever I read it, Neville is dyslexic. He's probably a little bit dyspraxic as well, okay?
He kind of is the magic version of that, isn't he?
He is. And, you know, there was the whole kind of thing that at one point they thought he might be a squib as well.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of performance anxiety going there. His grandmother's constantly talking about how amazing his parents were. And also, it's pointed out that Neville's problems, it's not that he's bad at subjects, it's that he's being pushed into subjects that he's not actually got an aptitude for. And the subjects that he does have an aptitude for, he gets excellent results in. So herbology and charms. He's really, really good at these things to the point that, well, they did it in the films, they didn't do it in the books. In the films, he's the one who helps Harry figure out what to do for the second trial, in the Goblet of Fire.
Well, it should have been him, really, because he had that book on herbology in the dormitory, didn't he? But Harry doesn't ask anybody for help, so so Neville would have quite happily said, "Oh yeah, you just need to take this," but Harry never asked anyone for help, so that bit never happened. It was kind of an aborted bit of arc deliberately.
Neville also basically, in the absence of Harry, and Ron and Hermione, he really steps up in terms of, becoming a leader figure and a leader figure within the rebellion at Hogwarts.
Yeah, he and Ginny run it together, don't
They
they?
do, yeah. And I really, really like that as well. An interesting, Ron and Neville kind of occupy the same archetype in some levels.
Yeah, I mean, Rod's slightly more the sarcastic best friend, isn't he?
He is slightly more the sarcastic best friend, but he also occupies the best friend who's always hungry, who doesn't really want to do things, who kind of wants to go home in some senses, but then is ultimately loyal, but possibly a little bit jealous. They sort of occupy a similar kind of space in that regard. I'm not trying to minimize it down. It's a lot more complicated than that. But both go through a very similar character arc when it comes to magic. And it's pointed out that Ron, who was seen as not being very good at magic, you then find out that he was using a wand that wasn't his own. And there's something similar with Neville, and I'm not sure whether it's that actually he was also using a wand that wasn't his own.
Yeah, it was his father's, wasn't
Yeah,
it?
it was his father's wand.
Mean, there's a big
So,
deal about the wand choosing the wizard, and
yeah.
you have to have the allegiance of the wand. You can't just be given a wand, so.
So you again have to ask yourself how much of Neville's ineptitude is actually, and I say ineptitude in inverted commas, how much of that is down to expectation from other people, and that he was literally given his dad's wand. His grandmother wanted him to be his dad. She wanted him to fill this kind of shadow, and I suppose it was meant to be an honor thing. And maybe he was glad to have his father's wand, but at the same time, it wasn't his wand. And when Neville is given the chance to step out from the shadows of the heroes, so his father, Harry, he really excels, and he steps up. And I actually really like that because his growth comes when he is cut away from that best friend, if that makes sense.
Yeah, when he stops, I suppose when he, as you say, steps out of the shadow. I mean, there's the whole part at the end of the Deathly Hallows where Voldemort's like, "Oh, we will just have one house now," because his big obsession is that Hogwarts just has to be run by Slytherins, apparently. He's clearly never got over his school days. You know how some people are like, "Oh yeah, they were the best days of my life," and you're like,
Yeah,
"That's
like,
really, really sad," and it's kind of Voldemort is one of them.
yeah, he's really not over it.
And obviously, the sorting hat gets put on Neville's head, and Voldemort sets it on fire because that's what you do when you're a complete psychopathic
Maniac.
monster. And Neville pulls the sword out and beheads the snake. So it once again, it's the weak, it's the overlooked sidekick best friend character who pulls something off because they had no other way of getting at that bloody snake.
Yeah, they didn't. And I do like that. And in the film, they did another interesting thing, which was that at the moment of greatest despair, when they heard Harry was dead, it's Neville who steps forward and says, "Nah, he's still alive in what he inspired us to do, and we're not submitting." And I really like the power of that because it Because we say he stepped out of the shadow, and he did step out of the shadow, but it wasn't in a resentful, I don't need you anymore kind of way. It was in a, I've learnt something, I've been inspired by you, but I'm not you sort of way instead.
Yeah, and that's okay. It's okay for me. I mean, because he's the others never treat him badly, really. I think
No.
sometimes they overlook him a little bit,
Yeah.
but it's never malicious, and they're all quite loyal to each other as well, as in
Yeah.
towards Neville. But it's interesting in the fact that if you then echo this against Harry's father's group of friends,
Yeah.
where Peter Pettigrew is allowed to sort of tag along and clearly has big hero worship going on, and also serious jealousy, and the fact those two things don't go well together and eventually twist quite badly.
Yeah.
He was overlooked. He joined in the biggest bullies with the of the playground because that's where he wanted to be, and none of them really understood enough about themselves to see that that's what was happening and that he couldn't be trusted.
Yeah.
So I always thought that was quite a nice mirror between the two characters.
Yeah. Well, they did make a someone has made an excellent point, which is that all of the characters kind of mirror is sort of Harry is but were inverted in that Ron is very much serious. Lupin was very much Hermione. Luna was actually very much Severus Snape, and Peter Pettigrew was very much converted into Neville. And it just shows actually how a small thing can be different, but also how personal choice can change that.
Yeah,
So
those
with Luna
things.
Lovegood, she could have taken all of the bullying that she had and used her power and her great wits to enact revenge and been bitter about it, but she didn't. And
No.
instead, she made excellent friends.
Because she had, I think that's the important thing ultimately, the big difference with all of them is kindness.
Yeah. And again, we see that with Neville. Neville could have chosen to be, could have chosen to just hide behind Harry, could have chosen to be bitter. And scared and to allow his fear to run him. And he did have a lot of fear.
Yeah.
A lot and a lot of fear, which is understandable. Hogwarts is actually a pretty scary place. I mean, we all like, oh, I want to go to Hogwarts, but like, yeah, people died. They literally
Hogwarts
died
where I will be in danger of losing my life on a weekly
on a weekly
basis.
basis. I mean, I'm not even going to talk about just how dangerous the stairs are alone. There's a tree that tries to kill you, okay? The headmaster's like in a school with magic where they could probably put up barricades. He's there like, yeah, none of you kids go to this one place that I'm telling you not to go. Like, that would ever work. Like, come on.
It
For
is a
God's
hell.
sake.
Yeah, it's an Ofsted night. Can you imagine that fan fiction? Ofsted visits Hogwarts to
None
help
of
with
them
safety
get
nightmare.
out. Anyway, so my point is that Neville had a lot to be scared about, and he could have really kind of internalized that, and he could have been very embittered, and he could have been very envious and jealous, and he wasn't. That's not to say that I wouldn't understand why a character would be, but in when it came to that crisis moment, Neville stepped up, and that is the main attribute that we see in these kinds of characters. It's the same one we saw in Sam, in that when it literally comes to the pinch, they step up, and it's usually because they step up. They step up when the hero can't do it alone anymore, and the hero actually suddenly has to realize. And there's always that, it's very cheesy. Oh, I wasn't the hero. You were the hero all along.
The
And I'm
thing is,
always
it's
like,
true.
well, otherwise, I'm just like, yeah, but can it not be that you were just a unit? Instead of having to sort of feel like, I'm on my own, I'm on my own, I'm on my own. Oh, another person has come. They are the hero. Hooray. And I'm like, or you could have appreciated them the whole way through the story. That could have happened.
Well,
I don't
some of
know.
them do, don't they? I mean, Frodo appreciates Sam all the way through. I think John comes to appreciate Sam as well. All
Yeah,
these Sams.
all of these Sams.
I do want to just talk about Luna briefly because we've obviously touched on it, and you made a good point bringing her up and saying, you know, it's kind of a reflection of Snape. And in a lot of ways, that's true because Luna is sort of the female version of this, and we don't have very many female examples. But we're talking about the weird girl who isn't very fashionable and is interested in things that the rest of her age mates generally are kind of like, what are you talking about? Why would you think anyone's interested in that?
Yeah. I love it as well because, like, they had to go next level weird to make a witch weird.
Like, yeah, she had to be really, really X-Files, didn't she?
Like, really utterly next level because, like, sort of at school, kind of being everyone, even if you were a Harry Potter fan, if you came into class wearing a Harry Potter cloak and, you know, a witch's hat or something like that, you'd get laughed at. Like, people would take the rip out of you. At university, completely different. Like, I've got kids coming in with, like, it's great. We all love it, okay? At university, it's like a different universe. But at school, where kids are terrible, and we can all acknowledge this, children are cruel, it just wouldn't have been a thing. I mean, stepping out of any very rigid social structure was really, really dangerous because it could either tip in your favor or it could go completely the other way. So I mean, even I used to get laughed at for coming into a classroom with my nose in a book, you know?
Yeah.
So
I haven't got time to list all the things I was laughed at for at school.
But so for Luna, they had to be like, oh Christ, it's already a bunch of witches, what can we do to make her even weirder? And they had to create this whole new subspecies of mythology within this mythology, which all witches just thought was ridiculous. And it kind of would have been interesting if they'd gone the other way, in that Luna comes in and she's just really into muggle stuff. They did that with, you know, Arthur Weasley. But, like, people are like, oh, what are you doing? And she's like, I'm using a ballpoint pen instead of a quill and ink because seriously.
That's amazing! Yeah, you're right. And they absolutely did have to go next level weird. And it's brilliant. And to be fair, Ron, Hermione and Harry all think she is a bit weird to start with. Hermione's probably a bit less kind about it because obviously the altar that she worships at is intelligence.
Yeah.
And for a long time, she can't quite see that Luna is every bit as intelligent. It's just that this weirdness over the top makes her seem implausible.
Yeah, but the other thing is that Hermione's like, and I'm like, Luna's a Ravenclaw, okay? She's incredibly creative and an incredibly intelligent person. She just has a very different form of intelligence.
Yeah.
Actually, Harry bonds with Luna earlier on than you expect.
He does, and I think, again, because Harry's saving grace is his own kindness, and I think Luna's big saving grace, where she doesn't end up like Snape, is her kindness, and they kind of bond over that, and obviously shared grief.
Yeah, and I think they also bond over the fact that they've both lived as the freaks.
Hmm.
So Luna is the freak in the wizarding world, but for the first 11 years of his life, Harry was the freak in the school world,
yeah,
in the human world. So I think he can kind of appreciate what she's going through in a lot of ways and kind of understand the bullying, which I think is actually really, really nice, the way that they parallel that. And again, it shows the complete difference between James Potter and Severus Snape.
Yeah.
And yeah, the contrast. So I do really, really like that. Now, I have to talk about one of my favourite characters.
Yeah?
Jean. Jean Tannen.
Before you get into that, I'm just going to posit this as a theory, because I think this is a permutation of this unprepossessing, slightly large best friend. Mm-hmm. And that is the sort of big friendly giant type friend. And they don't have to be giant, as in 60 feet tall, just, you know, bigger than the average man, as it were, or bigger than the hero who is
the little John.
Yeah, exactly. The little John to Robin Hood. Oh, there's also Fezzik from The Princess Bride, who is played by Andre the Giant in the film.
Yeah.
And clearly isn't too bright, but again, is really, he's huge. He's very, very strong and powerful. You wouldn't argue with him. You literally cannot beat him in a fight.
Yeah.
But again, it's sort of loyal and kind, and it's that sort of character. And I was sort of thinking that I think Jean Tannen kind of feeds into that sort of permutation.
He does. Now, Jean Tannen is from the Gentleman Bastard sequence by Scott Lynch. You guys have all heard me talk about it before. I'm very obsessed with this series of books. I mean, he's introduced in The Lies of Locke Lamora. He's one of the core characters, him and Locke Lamora, oddly enough. And the two of them are utterly inseparable. They are fused to the point that actually, Locke's love interest, spoiler, Jules, sorry, Locke's love interest is kind of a bit jealous of his friendship with Jean.
It's not that much of a spoiler. I'd be quite surprised. I'd be surprised, at this
Yeah.
point.
She, because she's just there, like, oh, well, yeah, he always chose you. And I'm like, well, to be honest,
Where were you, Sabatha? You
yeah.
haven't been there for. I haven't even got to the end of the second book, but I can tell she's not going to turn up and I'm really fucked off.
Lady, where have you been? Of course, they're close with each other. But
It's
there is
like
a
he's
really nice bit.
pining for her for like. How many years now? I was like, for God's sake, Locke, just find someone else.
No, he's not going to find someone else. He loves Sabatha, and as much as I dislike her, that's just the way it is. But anyway, back to Jean Tannen. The first time Jean and Locke meet, it doesn't go well. Locke is from very low class. He was a catchfire orphan. He's lived life rough, literally as long as he can remember. He's very small to the point, and so malnourished to the point that actually, even as an adult, he's only sort of middle sized. He's actually quite a small and very thin man, because he just couldn't grow any bigger because of a terrible diet when he was a child. Jean Tannen is the complete opposite. Jean Tannen is soft. He was a merchant's son. His parents died in a fire. He's educated. He's very long sighted, so he needs glasses to see things close to him. And he's kind of the Piggy character. Oh, we probably should have mentioned Lord of the Flies because we have Piggy as well. But he was he's seen as this very kind of soft, vulnerable character who gets pulled into the Gentleman Bastards very quickly. And Locke doesn't like him immediately. He says he's not one of us.
It's actually very funny.
Yeah. And Jean flips and beats the living daylights out of him, because Jean is very, very strong and has a big temper. And Chains just stands back and watches.
Let him get on with it.
That's what you get for running a mouse lock. And Locke's like, ugh. And then Jean proves to be more intelligent, especially when it comes to numbers, than Locke is. And again, Locke is very angry about this. But Locke kind of decides to make his peace with it. And when he discovers that Jean is actually long-sighted, he steals a pair of spectacles for him as a kind of a peace offering. And Jean's like, oh, thanks very much. I mean, these aren't right for me, but thanks very much anyway. And Locke's like, damn it. And the pair just become inseparable from then on. And I really, really liked that because it starts off with Locke being very angry with Jean because he doesn't feel like he's part of the dynamic, because he sees him as fat and useless. And he Locke probably sees Jean as the kind of person that he'd steal from. And then it really does descend into envy. And you don't usually see that because usually it's on the other end. But Locke is obviously very envious, and resentful of Jean. And then he gets over it because he sort of realizes that Jean is like him, but just in a very different way. And the pair really complement each other from then. And Jean follows Locke around. Sabatha, when she does discuss it, kind of sort of says, you know, he's very loyal, he's almost like a dog. And Locke really gets very angry at that. And it's the first time I've really seen this version of that kind of friendship, since probably that Robin Hood Disney animated film.
Yeah, I'm afraid that sort of reared its ugly head in my mind as well. And you can't get away from it, really, can you?
No. And I love, because I love seeing that level of loyalty, but it's not loyalty just on one side. These are two men who really genuinely love each other and really genuinely appreciate each other. And whilst they both understand that Locke is definitely the mastermind when it comes to the schemes. Jean is not portrayed as stupid. In fact,
No.
he's not stupid. He's very clever in a lot of other ways. And whilst Locke is better at lying and better at sort of mummery, as they call it, and doing the con side of things, Locke is also useless, absolutely useless in class. Whereas Jean is a bit of a beast.
Although I did enjoy the bit where he's riding a barrel down on four other pirates shouting that the gods have sent your doom, motherfuckers. That did make
Tiny
me
little
laugh.
Locke Lamora.
Completely lucks out.
Completely lucks out, and everyone's like, oh my god, Locke, he's some sort of crate. We saw him charging at these berserkers, and now, like, and he killed four of them, and we saw him riding a barrel laughing maniacally. And John's like, Locke, what the hell happened? And Locke's like, ah, oh, two of them tripped over, the barrel landed on the other, and one slipped on the beer, and I just slit their throats. And John's like, okay.
But John's even more sort of like, what were you thinking? And Locke's like, yeah, well, I was so terrified I kind of came out the other side.
And I really like that. Jean is one of my absolute favorite characters, and his dynamic with Locke is brilliant. And I would love to see more versions of that, of the psychic character who is, and this is the other thing, is Jean kind of gets a little bit more into shape because they're on the run. He doesn't get they are starved for a bit, they run out of money. Then they're working hard labor on a ship. But Jean never becomes a small man. He never just becomes solid muscle. He's always actually quite big. And this is the other thing. Jean definitely gets more sex than Locke.
Yeah, and he's I would say he's actually more intellectual as well.
He is,
So his
definitely.
appreciation for arts and things that, really aren't necessarily much of a benefit to a professional thief is
Yeah. He likes reading romance and poetry, and this and his intelligence as well as his strength is actually the thing that ends up attracting the ladies. And I really like that because it goes completely against the grain of, oh no, it's got to be someone who's thin and very good looking. And it's not. Jean is good looking, but as in it, none of them are actually described as good looking apart from Sabitha because Locke is obsessed with her. None of them are described as handsome. Jean is fat. That is how he's described. He wears little round spectacles. And he gets jumped on by at least two women in the series so far, have been like, ooh, I like this guy. And it's nice, it's accurate in that they thought this is a guy who's sweet, intelligent, and strong. And it's just the most accurate thing I've ever seen so far. Because really realistically, why would you go for the skinny, sarcastic, weedy
Well, yeah.
who's more concerned about stealing from you?
And also, someone who just literally never rests, therefore, they're never restful to be around.
No, Jean, and yeah, as I said, Jean is my absolute one of my absolute favorite characters, as well as Locke, and I love their dynamic, and I love the loyalty between them, and the fact that Jean will take charge to the point of literally grabbing Locke and dragging him out. And Jean will not take shit from Locke either. In fact, to be honest, Locke is more likely to take shit from Jean and just apologize for it.
Yeah. Okay, just while we've still got a little bit of time, we're just tracking back to sort of female permutations of this sort of character, and there aren't very many examples really. One that I can sort of come up with, although I'm cheating a little bit because she's kind of a main character in her own right as well, is from T'Amora Pierce's Circle of Magic series, which is Triss Chandler, and she is described throughout the series as being short, plump, also red-haired, bespectacled, long, sharp nose. So,
Yeah,
clearly not what hot.
heaven forbid that you that you have some weight to you and you wear glasses, I say as I lie in bed with some weight to me wearing glasses.
And as you say, bespectacled, a bit overweight. The thing is, she gets kind of picked on by various different people throughout the series for that, and it's stupid because she is the most demonstrably powerful member of the circle in any
Naturally.
Sense of the word.
Yeah.
Well, no, she can literally throw lightning at people. It starts off that they all don't know that they've got this ambient magic, and yeah, so she and she is again bookish. She is, but underneath everything, you know, she's her shape is just her shape kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's not something that's massively going to change with without her making herself really, really ill. So and sort of wasting away to nothing. And it's just a case of she's actually not unfit underneath it all, because she does do a lot of walking and riding and things like that. So she is relatively fit. It's just that she's just not naturally a tall, slender person, because she isn't. And she is probably the sharpest witted of all of them and demonstrably the most powerful. And it's just really interesting that that is as close as I can get to a female example other than, say, Luna Lovegood, which is sort of suggests that there is a real problem with
allowing female characters to be
anything other than a particular size and shape.
Yeah. And I mean, we see it every now and again, and it's the fat, stupid girl or the fat, nerdy girl, and they're usually the butt of the joke. I think another example of that is in the Worst Witch books, where we have, and for the life of me, I cannot remember her name, and I don't know if you know it, Jules.
I only know because I looked it up. It's Maud Spellbody.
That's right. And she's obviously the best friend, and she's fat as well, or larger. And it's kind of, they're just not seen as being adequate because of it. And it's really sort of, well, very demoralising, really.
It's just, I don't know, it's not very representative. I mean, I will say that the Tamora Pierce example is that she just writes people of lots of different body types and shapes.
Because
that's what... And you know, ethnicities and sexualities and things, because she believes in, you know, a wide, diverse cast, and I'm all for that. But yeah, the default seems to be that, you know, if you have a slightly podgy best friend, then obviously they can't be the actual hero of their own story, and I think that's the real issue.
Yes. And that's why, in the Kestrel saga, my main character... is not particularly thin.
Yeah, there is also, not a female example, unfortunately, there is Arthur Brown from the Deptford Mice trilogy. And he's a mouse, but he's a podgy little mouse.
He's a podgy mouse.
He's a podgy mouse. He's not, he's kind of the main character's brother. Well, no, yeah. He is the main character's brother. And I kind of like him. He's probably one of the most sensible characters. And... Robin Jarvis himself has kind of said that in all his books, he has on some level inserted himself as a short, fat, jolly character who always gets into scrapes and comes off badly for it because he's just not designed to get into fights.
Aww.
And he's like, well, no, this is me. This is me having a place in my own story, and I refuse to apologise for it. And I'm like, I really like that. And they're always such great characters.
I can get
characters.
Behind that.
Yeah. And they are always such great characters. Because I think there is a temptation for authors to put themselves in stories and make themselves everything that they're not, rather than what they actually are. And I'm not saying one's better than the other, because who wouldn't want a little bit of fantasy sometimes? But it's just, it's nice to see this represented in a case of that he just happens to be fat. There's nothing wrong with it kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And also that fatness does not necessarily equate to nerdiness or to dumbness.
Yeah.
You can be brave and fat, oddly enough. You can also be actually quite active and fat. That's the other thing. People seem to think that fat equates lazy. So, yes. I think we've run out of time, Jules.
No, we are at the end of the show.
Well, before we go then, do leave us a comment, listeners, our favourite listeners, as opposed to the unfavourite listeners, but we don't talk about them.
We don't
tell
have
us who you.
unfavorite.
Shh, we don't talk about them, Jules. Leave us a comment. Tell us who your favourite brave, usually fat side characters are. And do you agree with us? Disagree with us? And can you think of any female characters who sit within that archetype as well? Before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. And Jules, I think you've got one for this week.
I'm going to start this with a caveat saying this is probably not going to be for everyone. And it's a book you need to bring your brain for, so this is not pure entertainment. Having said that, it was absolutely brilliant, and I'm still kind of reeling a little bit from having read it, and it's The Traitor Barrow Cormorant by Seth Dickinson, which is a geopolitical fantasy novel.
Right.
Featuring a main character who, as a disenfranchised member of a community which is colonised by the Empire, she's a very bright child, so she's taken into one of their schools. This is what the Empire does. They come in, they conquer, they colonise, they impose their hygienics laws on people. I'll explain the hygienics laws in a minute. And then take their bright, promising children into their schools and re-educate them in the mould of the Empire to show their success. And it's actually a brilliant piece of strategy in that respect. Baru does not like the way that the Empire does things, and she sets out to destroy the Empire from within.
Right.
And yeah, it's heavy on the politics, it's heavy on an understanding of economics and things, although it walks you through everything. But this is not a fantasy novel in the sense of there's dragons and magic. There's nothing like that.
Yeah.
This is a fantasy novel in the sense of it is a completely imaginary setup, and yet it's very reflective. And it pulls no punches at all. When I'm talking about the hygienics laws, the encrastic discipline is what the Empire calls it. Baru comes from a community where sexuality and sexual preference is all very free. She has two fathers and a mother. They all live together.
Right.
This is unhygienic, according to the Empire, and any permutation of that, any sort of woman on woman, man on man, anything like that, anything that deviates from what they perceive as a set norm is unhygienic. And occasionally the message is a little heavy-handed. It's not a homophobic book, but it portrays homophobia in a way that you really cannot shut your eyes to.
Right.
So in that respect, it can be quite difficult. And as I said, it pulls no punches, and there are some really unpleasant bits in it as well. Having said that, I still really recommend it. It's a really, really good book. It's very intelligent, it's clever, and I think it's a scream for social justice without actually being strident. It gives you a good story. It doesn't sacrifice story on the altar of agenda, in my opinion. But having said that, this is not typical fantasy, and it may not be for everyone.
Okay. Well, on that note, we'll say thanks very much for listening, guys, and we'll catch you next week.
Yeah, thanks, goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.